Good evening, everybody, and welcome to Radio EduTalk. My name is David Noble in Dalgetty Bay in Scotland, and absolutely delighted this evening to be joined by Professor Paul Kirschner of the Velten Institute, Open University in the Netherlands. And this evening we're going to be looking at urban legends in education. What does good science say? Good evening, Paul, and welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, David. It's an honour to be on it this evening.
And over the next half an hour or so, we'll be getting an introduction to this evening's topic from Professor Kirschner. And you can get in touch if you're listening to the live show at any point. There's two main ways to contact the show, to put your comments or questions to Paul. You can email edutalker@hotmail.co.uk. That's EDUTALKR. Or if you're on Twitter, you can pop something up and include the hashtag EduTalk, EDUTALK. Now, whether you're listening to a live show or the podcast, you can also get access to some key links that Paul's kindly offered up to do with his writing from recent years with some collaborators. And you can access these PDF files and other links by going to edutalk.cc, which you might like to do at the moment just before we get into the main part of the show. Go to edutalk.cc and then you'll see near the top of the page there'll be a link for you to click on. When you go in there, it'll open up a Dropbox file with lots of key links. And in there we also have some reflective questions that Paul is offering listeners, maybe to help with your interaction and consideration of tonight's topics. The four questions are: can children in particular and people in general really multitask? Secondly, are digital natives really information competent learners, or ICT savvy technology users? Thirdly, does knowledge really have an ever decreasing half-life? And finally, why are myths and legends so prevalent and so hard to expunge? Just before we hear your introduction, Paul, could you just give us a kind of brief background to your career in education and your present roles?
Okay. The question is where to begin. First, because people can't see me, I was born in 1951. That makes me 62 years old at this moment, going to be 63. At one point in my life, I was a teacher of mathematics and science at the high school level. And because I got frustrated that the children who should be able to learn very, very well and very, very easily weren't learning, I decided I wanted to delve deeper into the topic. And I eventually became a full professor of educational psychology, and now I'm a program director of a program called Fostering Effective, Efficient, and Enjoyable Learning, as you said, at the Welten Institute Research Center for Learning, Teaching, and Technology at the Open University of the Netherlands. But I'm also a visiting professor of education with a special emphasis on learning and interaction in teacher education at the University of Oulu in Finland. Some affiliations. I was president of the International Society of the Learning Sciences. I'm on the Scientific Technical Council of CERF. That's the Foundation for University Computing Facilities, kind of like JISC in the United Kingdom. I was a member of the Dutch Educational Council, so I advise the Minister of Education. I'm a chief editor of the Journal of Computer-Assisted Learning and Associate Editor of Computers and Human Behavior. I've authored one book, which has now been translated, in its second edition has been translated into Chinese and Korean. It's called 10 Steps to Complex Learning. And I've co-edited other books, and that's about it. I mean, I could continue for the next half an hour, but I won't.
Yeah, and there's a link to your bibliographic notes in the Dropbox file that I mentioned earlier on. Yeah. So without further ado, we'll get into tonight's topic. So as I said, we're looking at urban legends in education. What does good science say? So I'd like to invite you, Paul, just to introduce the topic.
Okay, I will. As I spoke to you about, I'm not going going to present a lecture for 20 or 30 minutes, but I'm going to try somewhere in about 5 to 7 minutes, sketch the situation. Mark Twain, real name Samuel Langhorne Clemens, once wrote the following piece of text. He said, "In religion and politics, people's beliefs and convictions are almost every case gotten at second hand, and without examination from authorities who have not themselves examined the questions at issue, but have taken them at second from other non-examiners, whose opinions about them were not worth a brass farthing." That's kind of like what I think about what we're doing at the moment with respect to education and educational innovation. You could substitute the word "in religion and politics" and say education, and say in education, people's beliefs and convictions are almost every case gotten at second hand and without examination. We have a number of educational gurus running around the world, from Sir Ken Robinson to people talking about holes in walls in India, Sugata Mitra. In the Netherlands, you have people talking about Homo sapiens. You have Mark Prensky in the United States. And they're all propagating these incredible ideas about education. But the problem with all of them is they've never done a piece of research. It's all based upon observation and conclusions that they've taken from those observations. And I'll give you a good example of a fairly old one. And I think one of them that most of your listeners or podcast listeners probably know of, and it's called the Learning Pyramid. And it's either associated with a guy named Bales or Bates or Dale. That's also strange. We get completely different names with it. And it's kind of like the Zen sequel to if you give me a fish, I'll feed you. You'll feed me for a day. If you teach me to fish, you'll feed me for my whole life. It's kind of like what I hear, I forget. What I see, I remember. And what I do, I understand. And it sounds really good. And they come with these really great percentages of 10% you remember, 10% of what you read, 20% of what you hear, 30% of what you see, 50% of what you hear and see, okay, 70% of what you say and write, and 90% of what you do. So it's kind of the idea, if I tell it to you, you're going to forget it very quickly, and you'll only retain about 10% of it. But if you experience it, you'll remember 90% of it and remember it for a long time, which is really, really strange. There are a number of reasons. There, Lally wrote a really good article about it. But the problem is it's attributed to the National Training Laboratory and for Applied Behavioral Sciences from somewhere in the 60s. And if you get in touch with them, which I have, they'll tell you that, it sounds good. We think it's right, but we can't find any research supporting it. We have no numbers to support it. And if you look a little bit more deeply, you find it's all variations of what Edgar Dale wrote in a book about using media in education in 1946. It was revised in 54 and 69. And that's what he called the cone of experience. And what he did is he said, well, we have these media, and these media vary with respect to abstraction and concreteness. And he says, well, text and verbal symbols are very, very abstract and complex. I mean, there's no reason why an A looks like an A and sounds like an A. And you have direct, purposeful experience, and that's very low in abstraction, very high in concreteness. You know, I can tell you that something is hot, but if you are an Eskimo, you might not know what hot is, or if you've never seen fire. And if you put your hand in a fire, you'll experience it, and you'll know what hot is. So for certain things, it sounds really, really good. Yeah, but the problem is with that is that they don't take into any account when they're talking about all of those percentages, they don't take into account that it depends upon the nature of the material or the age of the learners or the delay between studying and testing, or the type of assessment, or even your prior knowledge. I mean, a very good example of that, if you say text is, so let's say, more abstract than symbols, the Voyager sent out a satellite in the 60s or the 70s from the United States, and they had this plaque on it in platinum. But there was only one or two problems with that plaque, because they thought, well, we can't do it in words because they'll never understand it. But that plaque was really a problem because it had something, for example, showing the trajectory of the satellite. Sorry, sometimes I have to grasp for words because I think in Dutch. But the problem was that that trajectory was given with an arrow. And if you don't come from a hunter society that made use of a bow and arrow, you really don't understand the meaning of an arrow. And if you don't have two eyes, you can't see that there's supposed to be something called depth of field within that. And you don't see that a man is standing behind a woman, but you see something completely differently. So what you know, your prior knowledge, the way you look at it, the nature of the material, that all determines how you'll relate to it. So such a really great idea of that learning pyramid, according to all research that's been done about it, says that it's a complete hogwash. But the problem is it's incredibly, 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 hard to get rid of. People believe it because it sounds good. They want to believe it. And if when it sounds good, it's reached the point in which what is it called in English? A board of education in a national board of education in Belgium has determined that all of the advanced courses in English have to be set up according to this learning pyramid. While it's all it is a legend that someone readapted a illustration trying to show a metaphor for concreteness of media, has transformed it into something, and they've even gone fraudulent. They've cited articles by Mickey Chi in which those things were said, and I've spoken to Mickey. I saw her about 3 weeks ago, and she says, I never put that in my article, that somebody citing an article of mine and adding their own illustration to it, which was never in our article. That's how far it's gone. I use the term often urban legend when I talk about this. It's a widely circulated story, often believed to be true by the teller, but usually distorted, exaggerated, and made sensational. It sounds good. People want to believe it, but there's no truth to it. And I don't know if you know in the UK these urban legends, but you have the vanishing hitchhiker, or the woman with the bouffant hairdo in which spiders lived, or the woman who came home with her – it's always a woman – with her little dog that got wet, and 30 years ago she put it in a dryer, and now she puts it in the microwave oven. Those are all of these types of urban legends. And the problem is we also have them in education. And I think maybe that would be my best beginning, except if I were to add to that one more thing. And most of these urban legends are what you might call being based upon faith. When people hear people saying, I believe this, I believe that, I experience this, I see that. And that a belief is a faith, and it's based upon assumptions and convictions that something is true. It's often accepted without proof, and it's really static and hard to kill. And what I'm going to try to do in the next, 20, 25 minutes is talk to you and your listeners more about science, which has nothing to do with belief. It's knowledge based upon a systematic and usually strictly tested set of propositions and theories. It's accepted or rejected after proof, and it's dynamic and changeable. And I think the best example of that is when CERN, a year or two ago, found a subatomic particle that it thought went faster than light. Instead of, on the one hand, people yelling, that's heresy, it's impossible, and instead of, on the other hand, saying, this is the absolute truth, CERN asked all of the different, cyclotron science groups in the world to redo the experiment and see whether or not what they found actually was the case, or whether it was a mistake in measurement or something like that. That's science. That's when you constantly ask and look at alternative hypotheses. Question what you see. Question what is told to you, instead of accepting something second and third hand that, as Mark Twain said, usually isn't worth a brass farthing. That's it.
Paul, I've been reading a lot of your work over the last few days, and really interested in your writings around multitasking and it being a kind of something that's not possible for a start, and also attempts at multitasking are inefficient, basically, and a waste of resources within a learning setting. Can you tell us a bit more about the kind of research that's gone into you kind of reaching that conclusion? Okay. And I suppose to some of us it may be kind of counterintuitive. We've been brought up in recent years hearing about the need for us as teachers to change the curriculum and to change our pedagogies in light of the fact that we're working with so-called digital natives?
Okay, well, that's three different questions in one. I'll try to go into all of them. The first is about multitasking, okay? I think it's first necessary to define multitasking. Multitasking means being able to carry out two information processing activities at the same time. It comes originally from computer sciences, information technology, and as we know, a single-core computer can only carry out one thing at one time, and a multi-core computer, it has multiple processes, can carry out multiple things, okay? It can multitask. So a computer can do that. The problem is our brain, the cognitive architecture of our brain, does not allow us to carry out two thinking or information processing activities at the same time. And then people say, ho, 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 I can do two things at once. That's no problem. And they give things like walking or whatever. And you have to remember, I'm talking about information processing. So something that has been automated, as a cognitive scientist, as an educational scientist, I say, if it is automated, it means by definition, there is absolutely no information processing going on, okay? There's no thinking going on. So that's the first thing. That is multitasking. And I'll give you a small example, even with those things that are automated, like walking. If you're walking down a street, one of the major problems at the moment, by the way, one of the major problems, I think I'm being a little bit too dramatic about this, what we find is that people who are immersed in thought or who are checking their mail or whatever tend to do things like fall off of sidewalks or walk under cars. And I don't know if you've ever done it yourself, but if I'm walking and talking to someone and really deeply immersed in a conversation, and I put my walking on automatic, and I don't register anything that's happening around me, and I don't think about it, I tend to do things like walk into lantern poles or step wrongly off of sidewalks and things like that. What we can do is we can task switch. That's going from one task to the other. Okay? And in going from one task to the other, we tend to restart and refocus, which means we lose time, yeah, and we lose accuracy. But what happened is somebody like Mark Prensky, he saw children looking at a telephone and apparently seemingly doing two things at the same time, but they weren't doing two things at the same time. They were switching from one to the other. But it was going so quickly that he couldn't see that, but he never did any research on it. That's the major problem. People who have done research find the problem following. For example, David Mayer from he's from Michigan University, head of the cognition and neuropsychology department. He said when people attempt to complete many tasks at one time or alternate rapidly between them, errors go way up and it takes far longer, often double the time to get the jobs done if they were done sequentially, okay? Because the brain is compelled to restart and refocus, yeah? There was research on, for example, children or I think it was digital natives, as they're often called. These were 17, 18, 19-year-old university students who were asked to read a text without texting at the same time or reading a text and allowed to retext, to text at the same time. And what they found was that it took approximately 1.8 times the amount of time to learn that text to mastery if you were text messaging at the same time as compared to if you were just reading it. So in other words, it's possible to try to do two things at the same time, to try to multitask and to learn to mastery. But the major problem is that most students don't spend twice as much time on that. I did a piece of research dealing with Facebook and learning, and we found that people who do what we call interruptive Facebooking, that means disruptive Facebooking, while they're studying, also make use of Facebook and answer people, tag things and whatever, have a grade point average that's 1 to 2 points below those who don't do that. But when we ask them, how long did you study? They studied the same amount of time. They're also online the same amount of time. So in other words, they didn't spend the 1.8 amount of minutes, hours, days, or whatever studying as compared to the people who studied without trying to do it. Serially working is always more effective, more efficient. There's with multitasking, task switching, you have a loss of speed and you have a loss of accuracy. And I could give you a whole list of articles on that, but I'd say one of the things on the document that you posted is to an article called Do Learners Really Know Best? Urban Legends in Education. And instead of boring the people who are listening with a lot of names and dates, I'd say you could look at that and that would be best. If I can add just one more thing, two more things. One, this has not only been shown at the learning level, but also at the neuron level, so the level of firing neurons in our head. Yeah, that there's a cognitive bottleneck within our brains. That's also been proven. And I'm going to tell you about a little piece of research done by two pieces of research. One done by Strayer. He did a piece of research in a simulator. An auto simulator, and it was really a nice thing. It was a simulator of just driving the car, and you had three different conditions. One was someone who was just driving the car, one was someone who was driving hands-free, and one who was driving drunk. And the person who was driving without just driving did the best, but the person who caused the most accidents took the most time to regain speed, braked at the slowest speed, was the person talking on the telephone and not the drunk driver. The drunk driver didn't have any accidents the person who was talking on the telephone in the group, in the population, there were 3 accidents. But what was even worse is when they asked the drivers afterwards, what color did that little girl, was that little girl's jacket that walked out between the 2 cars on the right while you were driving? The drunk driver said red. The person talking on the telephone said, what little girl? In other words, they were so engrossed in talking on the telephone, and I assure you it wasn't rocket science that they were talking about, that the drivers did not see what was going on around them. A second interesting piece of research was by Ophir and Nass in the article. That's why I'm saying it. And that was they had digital natives look at a screen, and the only thing they had to do was concentrate on blue squares, or actually blue rectangles, that were on the screen. And every once in a while, a red rectangle came onto the screen, and they were, you know, checked with eye tracking measures what people looked at. And the people who were said that they were good multitaskers and did it very often were not capable of blotting out, yeah, so not paying attention to that stimulus that they weren't supposed to pay attention to. So your question of we as teachers are being told to make use of this and let children multitask, what you're actually doing is possibly heightening their inability to concentrate if you do that. So that's kind of like a major problem, okay?
And, Paul, you mentioned in what conclusion to one of your papers, you state that the aim of all instruction is to add knowledge and skills to long-term memory. If nothing has been added to long-term memory, nothing has been learned. And does this kind of link with, I think you picked up in somebody else's phrase, the butterfly effect, and does this tie in with the inability of... Yeah, sorry, when you go.
Yeah, no, I'm sorry. I'm interrupting you. Finish your word.
No, I'm just maybe coming on to...
answer that I interrupt you. Sorry.
Yeah, I don't want to chip in 3 questions. I'll kind of leave it there. But it's interesting, you know, you're writing about kind of problem solving and the fact that working memory is not sufficient. It has to be committed to long-term memory. What you seem to be alluding to is this kind of butterfly effect maybe through people's use of social media. So can you tell us a bit about your research or your examination of others' research into the whole issue around problem solving and committing knowledge to long-term memory?
Okay, now that's a very good question. The actual term is the butterfly defect and not effect. I call it attention deficit hyperlink disorder. Gabriel Solomon came up with that term, and what he said was that what people do when they're working with hypertext learning environments and things like that is that they flitter from one piece of information to another piece of information. Interesting, though it may be, but it's and the problem with them is that they don't have the cognitive schema in their head, I'm going into Dutch, in which to place this information that they're getting. So they're lacking the basic knowledge to be able to really think about and make use of the new information that they're finding. How can I say this best? I'm going to try to do it now in English. The point is, if we go back years and years ago, and now I'm going to go back into the 1930s and 1940s, so it's almost the Stone Age. I think fire was just invented at that point of time. And Jean Piaget said that when a person is learning, when a child is learning and developing, what he or she does is he or she assimilates new information into the schemas. Jean Piaget didn't use the word schemas. That's what John Anderson was when that came into view. But let's say he said assimilation is when you see something and you can add it to your own knowledge base. So you assimilate knowledge from outside. And the way you do it is you are have a way of interpreting it, seeing it, because you already have knowledge. You see, oh, that thing with four legs is also a cow, but a different type of cow. Okay? If you look at a child, it's kind of like a dog. You probably learn about a dog earlier than a cow. And they'll look at it and they'll say, oh, that's also a dog. It does woof, woof, woof. And it looks like, but I don't have this, so I'll put that into my memory as a dog. And the only way that child can interpret it is because that child has already seen other dogs and knows what a dog is. I mean, you know, that's all bit behind it. And the second part, from what Jean Piaget talked about, was accommodation. And that's when you come across something, not once, but a number of times, and it doesn't fit into those schemas, into that knowledge pattern what you have in your head, you will then adapt, accommodate the knowledge in your head. So you're going around and you've learned woof, woof, dog, and you see all these different types of dogs, and you're going with your father or your mother on a bicycle here in the Netherlands in the farmlands, and you see a cow, and the first thing you say is dog, woof, 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 and all of a sudden things happen. This thing goes moo instead of woof, 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 and it eats grass, and you know, and all of a sudden it doesn't fit in your schema. It fits in your schema for animals, but it doesn't fit in your dog schema. So you accommodate that within your head, and hey, there's another type of animal that also walks on 4 feet or 4 legs, also has a head and a tail, but apparently is not a dog. So what we know, what determines what we see, and when it doesn't fit in, we either, if it fits in, we elaborate our schemas, and when it doesn't fit in, we accommodate our schemas. So that means in order to be able to understand, learn and understand anything, we need to have these schemas. Now let's bring it back to what we're hearing from people talking about working with internet, and why do we need to learn things? It's all on the internet. Yes, it's all on the internet. So well, bull, bleep, as things that are true, because anybody and everything can put something on internet. That's no problem. But the problem is, if you don't have knowledge in which to interpret it, it's impossible to know what information that now comes up in your browser, what is relevant, what is true, what fits into what you were planning on doing. It makes it impossible to see whether or not for that article that you're writing on, or that essay or report for school on good nutrition, you're not capable of interpreting, is this something from someone trying to sell their book, or is this good research? You have no way of placing it. So the idea of we don't need to learn those facts because it's already on the internet, it's impossible to find and interpret what you need from internet if you don't have the basic knowledge. And Saskia Brandt at my university is doing quite a lot of research on that. And she's found that that's actually the case. The less knowledge learners have, the less capable they're able to make effective and efficient use of the internet, Wikipedia or whatever, to accumulate new knowledge. I think one of the best anecdotal, but true, it's not an urban legend, you can go find it, is Michelle Bachmann. I don't know if the European readers know who she is, or listeners know who she is, but she wanted to be a Republican candidate for president in the United States. And she announced her Republican candidacy in Peoria, Illinois. And she opened it by saying, I'm really proud to be able to announce my run for presidency as Republican candidate for the presidency in this the birthplace of such a great American citizen. And she was talking about John Wayne. Unfortunately, some idiot in her group Googled it and found that there was a John Wayne born in that town where she announced the presidency. Unfortunately, it was John Wayne Gacy, a mass murderer of 23 young boys. So, in other words, you can really find some good things and jump from one piece of information to another on the internet. But if you don't have the basic knowledge to be able to understand, interpret, place, evaluate, and make use of it, it's of absolutely little or no use. So we need a good basic foundation, knowledge foundation, if we want to make use of the sources of information that we actually have. Okay?
Yeah. And Paul, we're coming into the last 10 minutes or so, if you're able to hang on and say that.
No problem.
If any listeners have got comments or questions for Paul, they can get in touch by Twitter, that's hashtag edutalk, or email, it's edutalker@hotmail.co.uk. I'm just wondering if we can maybe come back within the kind of learning setting or the classroom. I'm really interested that, you know, some of your writing, you've mentioned the importance for the teacher to ensure that the learner has some kind of autonomy, that there's a degree of shared control. I mean, you're not arguing for necessarily for the bad old days, but you do argue strongly that that young learners, I think if we maybe touch on now your kind of arguments against experiential learning, constructivism, co-constructivism of knowledge, etc., that where there's essential content or skills to be learned, young learners should not be asked to discover that either in a group of peers or on their own.
I mean, young learners in a group of peers are normally shared ignorance as opposed to something else. I mean, the point is, I can approach this from two ways. The first way is, let's do it from the scientific way, and that's if we look at our cognitive architecture, we have a very limited short-term memory. A little lecture on it. Things come into us through our sensory memory. What we attend to goes into our short-term memory, and what we process in some way, it could be repeating or whatever, eventually goes into our long-term memory. Our long-term memory is virtually limitless. Our short-term memory can retain things from anywhere from 2 to 30 seconds, and if you don't rehearse it or do something with it, you've lost it, and it's limited. Some people say approximately 4. We heard Baddeley, Cowan says 4 plus minus 1. Baddeley said 7 plus minus 2. But in any event, it's limited. And what we're talking about is pieces of novel new information. Okay? So our short-term memory for processing information is fairly small. If we ask people, and especially novices, to then try to discover something, the problem is they, all of this information is new, but they also have retained in their memory from, where am I? Where am I going? Is this getting me any closer to it? So what we're doing is we're giving them more what's called cognitive load. And at a certain point, the cognitive load is so large that the information can't be processed anymore. You get kind of lost in trying to organize your own processes that you're dealing with. So for a novice, it's not a very good pedagogy or way to learn, because it's not effective, not efficient. People who start go for discovering and trying to solve problems who don't know very much about it use a means-ends analysis. And that means-ends analysis is a very inefficient way of doing it. It's kind of like, I'm driving, I'm getting further, am I getting closer? And if you don't know very much about the subject, and you don't know what you know and don't know, and you don't know how to solve the problem, it's kind of very hard to determine if you're getting any closer to that in your means-ends analysis. So it's more like you discover it like the needle in the haystack. Now, that's completely different if you have a fairly good amount of background knowledge, yeah, then discovery or experiential learning or whatever can work. Because who knows best what they know, what they don't know, and what they need to learn to solve a problem? Those are people with quite a lot of knowledge. The problem is most of what we do at school is dealing with a novice. Most of the people who enter a biology course, a first-level biology course, don't know any biology. So if you try to use a pedagogy based upon the epistemology of the expert, which is discovery, doing research, and things like that, what you're doing is you're transforming the epistemology of a domain into a pedagogy for it. It's kind of like saying if the epistemology of the expert driver is driving the 24 hours of Monte Carlo or Le Mans, then we should teach people to drive by putting them in a Formula One car and having them drive the Grand Prix. And everybody would say, but that's completely absurd. A child, someone learning to drive a car, we can't have them learn in the same way that an expert in Ayrton Senna, who died, 20 years ago yesterday, or Michael Schumacher drives a car. You have to teach them. You have to teach them the rules of the road. You have to put them in a car with an experienced driver who then has brakes and steering and extra mirrors and things like that. That seems like the most normal thing in the world. But if we're talking about learning biology, all of a sudden people draw this type of blank stare. And of course, if biologists learn by doing research and discovering, let's teach children biology by learning, by having them do research, you know? So that's kind of like the problem with it. So the second thing that I wanted to say, as I said, everything you say leads to at least two things for me. What I am a proponent of is good instruction and eventually lessening the instruction as the learner gains more expertise in the domain and in the skills that he or she needs with respect to that domain. And that's called the expertise reversal effect from Slava Kalyuga. He says, and that says that instructional techniques that work with novices, work well with novices, probably won't work well with experts or could even be work negatively by experts. But the same is true. Instructional techniques that work well with experts probably won't work well or actually harm learning in novices. So it's not a question of one or the other. It's a question of giving control where control can be given and giving good support and guidance where good support and guidance needs to be given. Just like when we teach our children to ride a bicycle, first we have training wheels, then we raise the training wheels, then we take off the training wheels and hold on to the seat, then we let go of the seat every once in a while, but hold on to it when they're making a curve. Then let them try to make the curve. And every once in a while, we also let them fall because we know if they're wearing a helmet, they probably won't kill themselves. And that's the way we teach people to drive. And that's the way we teach people to ride a bicycle. And Vygotsky, speaking of the zone of proximal development, says, we should give support and guidance and only have people working at that stage where they just about, if they're standing on their tippy toes, can reach. And we're standing there giving them a hand, a metaphorical hand, helping them with instruction and support so that they achieve that next stage. Okay? If I can end it with, because it sounds like we're getting to an end, I'd like to just end this, what I'm saying, with two quotes, if I may. Okay? The first quote is that children today love luxury, have bad manners, have contempt for authority, disrespect their elders, are tyrants, contradict their parents, and tyrannize their teachers. I think all of the teachers, all of the parents that are listening either live or on a podcast would say, boy, That's really true. The second quotation is, the world is passing through troubling times. The young people today think of nothing but themselves. They are impatient of all restraint. They talk as if they knew everything, and what passes for wisdom with us is foolishness for them. That also sounds like the kids of today. And that's the reason why we're constantly saying things like, well, kids today are different. They're different than we were. They're different than 20, 30 years ago when this industrial way of teaching in which the teacher stood in front of the class and taught them things and told them what they should learn and this and that. Kids are completely different, so education has to be different. I don't know how many people know this, but that first statement was by Socrates in 300 BC about children as tyrants and not listening to their teachers. And the second one saying the children know it all was Peter the Hermit, who died in 1115. Kids today aren't very different than they used to be. It's just that we are getting older. My parents thought I was, you know, the worst thing that could happen when I was a teenager. My parents' parents thought that of them, and we think of it of our kids, and it's really not so necessary to go along with every hype. That doesn't mean we shouldn't make use of new insights and new knowledge with respect to learning, but that doesn't mean we should give children iPhones in the class or we should let them discover everything or whatever. Those are completely different things.
Paul, thank you so much for appearing in Radio Edutalk. I have got a couple of very quick questions, hopefully, just to finish up on, if you don't mind.
No problem.
I'm kind of misappropriating one of your quotes, but you talk about interruptions, distractions, and the irrelevant environmental stimuli. And some people, maybe yourself included, would argue that some kind of educational policies and practices that kind of fall into those kind of labels. So with that in mind, could you just recommend where teachers might go then for what you call the important stuff, the solid evidence-based practice?
Well, the first thing they should do is read my book, 10 Steps to Complex Learning. Plug, plug, plug. Yeah, if I was on a talk show, I'd be holding it up at the moment. I think there are a number of very good places. There's a thing called the pardon me that it's American, but it's called the American Educator from the American Federation of Teachers. It's it's read by a million teachers in the United States. Not that they learn anything from it. Please don't get me wrong. But they have very, very good articles by very, very good people like Daniel Willingham about cognition, cognitive science, learning, educational sciences, and what you can do with it as a teacher. If you go to their website from the American Educator, you'll see a number of articles from Daniel Willingham. I would suggest everybody read his books. That's Daniel Willingham. I would look at the work of John Hattie from New Zealand with respect to what works in education. He's wrote a really great book. Also, for teachers, he's written two or three books in the last 3 years on different techniques and what the effects of them are, and also specifically for teachers. So I'd read the books by John Hattie, that's Hattie, the work of Daniel Willingham. I'd look in the American Educator from the American Federation of Teachers. And what I would say is never, never, never accept something that someone says at face value, even if I say it. Ask for the evidence to prove it. And think about it. That's the most important thing. When someone says that you can multitask, think of yourself and say, when I'm sitting and talking to my colleague on the other side of the desk, and we're talking, and I look and I see something, a new email has come in on my iPhone or on my computer, and that person asks me a question at that moment, don't I often usually say, excuse me, sorry, I was looking at my computer, Pete, Mary, whatever your name is, I wasn't listening. Sorry, could you please repeat it? I think almost everybody has had that experience. The person who was sitting on the other side of the table, unless you're a rocket scientist, was probably not a rocket scientist. And the email that you got or the WhatsApp or the text message probably also wasn't rocket science, but you weren't capable of reading the name of the person sending you the email and the title of the email and at the same time process the question that you were hearing. You heard the question, but you couldn't process it. If you can do something that simple, that low level, how do you possibly think that a child is capable of texting, Facebooking, Snapchatting, and at the same time learning while listening to a teacher or reading something that's on his or her table in a book or on a computer? Use common sense. Okay? The second thing I'd say is get in touch with me. I'm very reachable. You know that yourself, David. It didn't take very much effort to get in touch with me. I usually answer within an hour of receiving an email. And I'm always happy to work with and help teachers, researchers, student teachers, or whatever, if they have a question or a problem. So you can always – it's my name, paul.kirchner@ou.nl, or follow me at p_a_kirchner on Twitter, and you can get in touch with me.
Paul, thank you so much for appearing on Radio EduTalk. It's been absolutely fascinating. I have got hundreds of questions. It'd be great to have you on the show again in the future. But
okay.
For now, best wishes.
No problem. Thank you very, very much, David, for having me. It was an honour and a pleasure. And hope to speak to you soon.